is awesome. It gave him the opportunity to work towards his fitness goals. Okay, I guess that was a good breakup then, I guess. I don't know. Or maybe, you know, he got a girl that's like, ooh, I need to work out. VOA1, the hit.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and John Russell. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Many Americans have been staying close to home since the start of the coronavirus health crisis. Those interested in traveling are now exploring where they can go on vacation this summer. They are discovering that such a trip may require coronavirus tests and even quarantines. States from Maine to Hawaii are trying to balance the need to contain the virus with urging out-of-state visitors to spend money at hotels, restaurants, and other businesses. Coronavirus containment measures get little support from many in the tourism industry. They fear that visitors will choose to wait things out until they can go without worrying about violating a state-ordered quarantine or searching for a testing station for the virus. Pauline Frommer is editorial director for Frommers.com and Frommer's Travel Guidebooks. She says discretion is the better part of valor during a health crisis. You don't want to die because you went on vacation, she told the Associated Press. Some states, like Hawaii, require quarantines for out-of-state visitors. Maine, Alaska, and Vermont have some version of a test requirement. In Maine, a state that calls itself Vacation Land, Governor Janet Mills provided an alternative to the 14-day quarantine. Visitors are welcome if they can show that they have been tested within 72 hours of arrival and are not carrying the virus. Operators of hotels and restaurants say the governor's measure falls short of what is needed to bring in tourists and save their summer season. We don't think visitors are going to jump through hoops like that, said Steve Hewens from Hospitality Maine, the state's tourism trade group. He worries that visitors will just go somewhere else. Hawaii Governor David Ige extended his state's required 2-week quarantine for all arriving travelers. However, state officials are trying to develop a process that could let some travelers return. Florida has recently reported an increase in coronavirus cases. The state requires a quarantine for visitors from New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. Those states have had some of the highest infection rates during the early days of the health crisis. New York officials now say they are considering requiring Florida visitors to quarantine. Travelers to Alaska who are tested upon arrival can avoid a quarantine if a test shows they do not have the virus. But visitors are told to limit their activities until they get a second test result showing no infection. In Vermont, visitors can cut short the required 2-week quarantine if they get a test after a week that shows no sign of infection. Tim Piper is president of the Vermont Inn and Bed and Breakfast Association. He noted there is pent-up demand. People are wanting to come to the state. Neighboring New Hampshire is requiring out-of-staters to prove to having quarantined at home for 14 days before staying at a hotel or other property. The state rejected the idea of requiring visitors to quarantine while they are on vacation. The safety concerns in Maine have a reason. The state has the highest percentage of people over age 65, the group most at risk to the coronavirus. Businesses, like hotels in Maine, say the test requirements are difficult, can be costly, and are not easily available. At the Cod Cove Inn, owner Ted Hugger wonders whether out-of-staters will pay for the tests, which can cost $150 per person. He also questioned whether testing would keep people safe since it is not required of children 18 years and under who are traveling with adults. It just doesn't make sense, he said. Hewins of Hospitality Maine does not like the idea of turning away families who have driven hours to vacation in his state. He likes the rules in New Hampshire, which has something closer to an honor system for visitors. Compared to some states, Maine has had fewer coronavirus infections and deaths. But Maine's governor worries that rural hospitals could have large numbers of coronavirus patients if millions of visitors arrived without observing safety measures. I can think of nothing more devastating than an outbreak or resurgence of this deadly, untreatable virus during tourism season, she said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Jokes can not only challenge your ideas and make you laugh, they can also teach you about grammar. Today on Everyday Grammar, we will show you how humor can help you with speaking, word stress, content words, and function words. Dick Gregory had a long career as a comedian. Gaining fame in the 1960s, he was involved in comedy and civil rights issues in the United States. Gregory continued performing late into his life. In the late 2000s, he recorded a special performance that dealt with politics, race, and even the questions of journalists, such as reporters from the Associated Press and CNN. Let us listen to part of it.
I came back in from Europe last month, CNN. Mr. Gregory, you think we'll ever catch Bin Laden? I say, we. I ain't looking for him. I'm still trying to find out who my daddy is.
Now, let's think about each of these lines.
I came back in from Europe last month.
Note that Gregory stresses, or says more forcefully, the words Europe and last month. The reason he does this is because Americans usually stress content words, words that carry the most meaning. Content words are usually nouns, verbs, adjectives, or adverbs. In addition, Americans often stress content words toward the end of the sentence. Let's listen to the next line from the recording.
CNN, Mr. Gregory, you think we'll ever catch Bin Laden?
In this question, Gregory tells what the journalist asked him. Note how he stressed the content words. He seemed to call attention to the nouns, Bin Laden, Mr. Gregory, and CNN. He also stressed the verbs think and catch, and the adverb ever. Note that he did not stress the pronouns you or we. He also didn't stress the auxiliary verbs. That is because these words are function words. Pronouns and prepositions are two examples of function words. So are auxiliary verbs, such as be or do. Americans generally do not stress function words when speaking, unless there is a good reason. Which leads us to our next line.
I say we.
In this question, Dick Gregory stresses the pronoun we. Although function words are usually not stressed, Gregory stresses it because he is noting its importance. He wants to make clear that he is not part of the we that the journalist is talking about. He then says the following.
I ain't looking for him.
Note that he does not stress the pronoun him, but he does stress the word ain't. This is a casual kind of negation. It is short for the words am not. Although Americans generally do not stress auxiliary verbs, in cases of negation, Americans sometimes stress them, especially if they want to show that they have a different opinion. In the next line, Gregory makes the surprising claim that he still does not know who his father is. Ask yourself, which words does he stress?
I'm still trying to find out who my daddy is.
In our report today, we examined two kinds of words in English, content words and function words. The idea is that function words show relationships between content words. Content words, nouns, verbs, adjectives, generally get stress because they are the most important words in the sentence. Function words, prepositions, auxiliary verbs, pronouns, often do not get stress because they are less important. But, as you have learned, in some cases, Americans stress function words, and when they do, it is likely for a good reason. The next time you are watching the news or a comedy special on the internet, listen to how the speaker stresses certain words. Over time, you will begin to note regular, repeated ways that English speakers stress words. And if they do something different from what you expect, then ask yourself why, and hopefully try to laugh and smile in the process. I'm John Russell.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact the doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Andrew Jackson, the seventh president, was unlike the earlier U.S. presidents. His family was poor, he had little education, and he lived on what was then the western part of the country. Jackson became nationally known in the early 1800s. First as a fighter against Native American tribes, and then as a general in the War of 1812 against the British. His image as a military hero and man of the people made him a popular choice for the presidency. But critics said Jackson did not accept any limits on his power. He is also remembered for supporting slavery and for forcing Native Americans from their homes. Andrew Jackson's parents were immigrants from Ireland. His father died in an accident before Andrew, the third and youngest son, was born. When the American colonies entered a war of independence, Andrew and his two brothers fought against the British, although Andrew was too young to be a regular soldier. Andrew's oldest brother soon died. Then Andrew and his other brother were both captured by British soldiers. One cut Andrew's face, leaving a scar that remained his entire life. But Andrew, unlike his brother, survived captivity. A short time later, Andrew's mother became sick and died. By age 15, Andrew Jackson had no living immediate family. He had already stopped attending school, but taught himself enough to become a lawyer. He moved to what became Nashville, Tennessee, where he developed a successful law career. In time, he bought land and slaves. Jackson was tall and thin, with red hair and bright blue eyes. Sometimes Jackson was playful. He loved to dance, hold parties, and play games where he could win money. Sometimes he was violent. He was known for getting angry easily. Jackson fought duels with several men. In one, he killed a man who insulted his wife. Yet many people liked Jackson's passionate, action-first personality. By the time the United States entered the War of 1812, Jackson had been a congressman, senator, and judge. Jackson did not have any officially recognized military training, but during the War of 1812, he volunteered in the Tennessee militia and quickly took control of troops. Many of his soldiers came to respect him. Jackson refused to give up, even when the government ordered the militia to disband. And when some of the men wanted to leave, he threatened them with a gun. Because he was uncompromising and strong as a tree, soldiers called Jackson Old Hickory. a group of Creek Indians, gave him another name. After he defeated them in battle, Jackson negotiated a treaty that punished both his Native American enemies and his Native American allies. The treaty was more severe than the U.S. government had asked. In time, it forced the Creeks, as well as several other tribes, off their land. The move was popular with many white settlers. It was less popular with the Creeks, who called Jackson Sharp Knife. His best-known military operation was in New Orleans, Louisiana. A large, experienced army of British soldiers moved to attack. Jackson defended the city with a small group of untrained soldiers. His group included volunteers, free blacks, Creoles, Native Americans, and pirates. Jackson's ragtag troops not only defeated the British force, but suffered only a few losses. Jackson didn't know that the battle came after the British and Americans had already agreed to end the war. But his victory there gave many Americans a feeling of pride. It also made Jackson famous. He became known across the country as the hero of New Orleans. Voters across the country supported Jackson, too. He was especially well-liked in the South and West. Many Americans saw him as a man of the people. They believed his success came from experience and hard work, not wealth and family connections. In the presidential election of 1824, Jackson received more popular and electoral votes than any of the other candidates. But because no candidate had a majority, lawmakers in the House of Representatives decided the election. Those lawmakers chose John Quincy Adams, the son of former President John Adams. They were persuaded, in part, because a leader in Congress named Henry Clay said Jackson did not have the temperament to be president. Immediately after Quincy Adams won, he appointed Clay Secretary of State. The appointment angered Jackson. He believed Adams and Clay had entered into a corrupt bargain. In the next presidential election 4 years later, Jackson defeated Quincy Adams in a landslide. And in the presidential election after that, he crushed Henry Clay. Jackson wanted to be a powerful leader who controlled a limited federal government, but he wanted that government to have power over state governments. For example, Jackson refused to let the state of South Carolina nullify, or ignore, a federal law that state officials opposed. Jackson said, if they failed to obey the law, he would consider them traitors and send in troops. In time, South Carolina and Congress were able to reach a compromise on the law. Jackson also refused to extend the charter of the National Bank. He believed the bank helped industrialists and businesses more than farmers and settlers. His move was popular with many voters, especially farmers and settlers. But Jackson's opponents warned against the bank veto. They disagreed with his economic plan, and they objected to how he had operated outside of Congress. Senators censured Jackson for acting as if he did not have to follow the law. Jackson's supporters fought back. They removed the official criticism from the Senate records. Jackson vetoed more bills than the first six presidents combined. He actively worked for only one major law, the Indian Removal Act of 1830. Jackson believed Native Americans occupied land that should belong to white settlers. He also thought Native Americans would be destroyed or lose their culture to white people anyway. So he offered several tribes what appeared to be generous treaties to move onto land west of the Mississippi River. But the treaties were often unfair or illegal. The tribes who accepted rarely received the benefits Jackson promised them, and some tribes, such as the Cherokees, simply refused to go. Empowered by Jackson's Indian Removal Act, U.S. government officials eventually forced 15,000 Cherokees off their land. They were made to march over 1,600 kilometers. About 4,000 died on the march. It is remembered as the Trail of Tears. For white settlers, Jackson's Indian removal policies resulted in over 100,000 square kilometers of new land to farm. Thousands of cotton planters moved west with their enslaved workers. The Indian Removal Act served not only to aid an economic boom in cotton, but to spread slavery further in the United States. Jackson had no objections. In 1837, Jackson officially moved out of the White House, but he did not really leave the presidency. He advised the presidents who followed him from his home in Tennessee. Jackson had particular influence over two future leaders, Martin Van Buren, his former vice president, and James Polk, who shared Jackson's beliefs so closely that he was called Young Hickory. Jackson's beloved wife, Rachel, had died before he took office. They did not have any children together, but they raised two boys, a Native American orphan who died as a teenager, and a nephew, whom they called Andrew Jackson Jr. The younger Andrew Jackson and his wife lived with the former president in his final years. He died in his bed at 78 of old wounds and old age, but his legacy remains very much alive. Jackson changed the U.S. presidency. After him, presidential candidates had to show they could connect with voters, not just lawmakers. He also increased the power of the chief executive. Jackson often questioned, or dismissed, the power of Congress, the Constitution, and the Supreme Court. And he began the custom of replacing experienced government officials with people whose main qualification was their loyalty to him. Critics added to Jackson's nicknames. They called him King Andrew, King Mob, or American Caesar. The opposition to Jackson led to a new political party called the Whigs. Part of Jackson's legacy is the two major party system that exists in the U.S. today. But those who loved Jackson really loved him. His humble beginnings, rise to power, and defense of the common man inspired them. In the U.S., the name of Andrew Jackson is still often used as a positive symbol of American democracy. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.